Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and he said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. This is the gospel of the Lord."
Thanks be to God.
You may be seated. This is one of my favorite texts in the entire Bible. It's probably a strange commentary on my thought process. I know it's not a particularly comforting passage in the classical sense of some of the Psalms. I mean, when I read it, I don't often feel peace. And yet, in some way, this passage is central to our understanding, both about who Christ is and about who we are now in relationship to Christ. And it's certainly pivotal to Mark's understanding. In the first 8 chapters, Mark locates Jesus in all kinds of strange places, among strange people. And that in itself makes a theological statement about the reign of God. And the next 8 chapters find Jesus en route to and having arrived in Jerusalem, a not-so-strange place, peopled with the powerful and the influential. And the contrasts are fascinating between the first half and the second half. Jesus spends the first part of Mark's gospel in Nebraska, and then he takes a fateful journey to Washington, D.C. And our text for today stands as the threshold, the point at which in Mark's gospel, Jesus makes the first move on his journey to Jerusalem. He's been here, and now he's going over there. It's portentous. It's a big deal. And the story picks up speed from here. Dr. Albert Outler tells the story of the warrior King Charles XII, who back in 1716 visited a little village seaport named Ystad in the south of Sweden. King Charles arrived unexpectedly at the village church for worship. And when the pastor realized that the king was at the service, he reflected about what he's going to say in his sermon. What should he do? Should he preach the message that he'd prepared? Or should he take this opportunity to praise King Charles and the royal family for its leadership of Sweden? Well, he decided to lay aside the sermon. After the service, the king greeted the pastor, and he went finally on his way. And a little while later, the church received a special gift from the king. The pastor called the congregation together to share in the opening of this great big gift. And when the box was open, there's this huge life-sized crucifix. And attached to the cross was a note from the king which said, "Let this crucifix hang on the pillar opposite the pulpit so that all who stand there will be reminded of their proper subject." Well, we've read the final chapter, and we know what happens when Jesus gets to Jerusalem, as of course did Mark's readers. So we can't help but read our text for today with a sense of foreboding. We know what it's ultimately going to cost Jesus as he makes this final prophetic, proleptic speech. And so we cover this tough passage once again because somewhere at the center of it all is what we confess about who Jesus is and who we're supposed to be now because of him. I mean, this passage looms as a kind of constant reminder of what it is for all of us to know and to understand the proper subject of our faith. Cross. The cross, of course, stands at the end of this journey for Jesus, and it is the cross that Jesus, in the text this morning, commands his disciples to take up. Well, according to Mark, Jesus knew as he walked down the narrow path that day that there was no way for him to be faithful to the purposes of God and avoid that cross. He knew, as it says in verse 31, that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected and be killed. And he had to be willing to walk that way anyway. In David James Duncan's great book, The Brothers K, the family is discussing this little girl who's at the church, and she was born with a cleft palate. Her name is Vera. And her parents won't let her have an operation to fix her lip because it is, as they say, her cross to bear. One of the brothers, Peter, observes that there were some crucial things Vera's parents were forgetting about crosses. One was that Jesus was nailed to his by his enemies, not by Mary and Joseph. And another, he said, was that it killed him. Christ's cross killed him. We've got to remember what crosses are. They're not just decorations on steeples. They're murder weapons. The same as guns or gas chambers or electric chairs, only much slower. So Vera's parents were one of two things. They were either fools without the slightest idea what Christianity or crosses are, or they were unbelievably evil people. Well, whether or not you agree with Peter's assessment of the situation, we have to make note of the fact that Jesus isn't just talking about some subjective experience. The cross is not something... The cross is something that we decide to bear, something that we take up, not just a physical infirmity or our aches and pains, as burdensome as those things are. This is a voluntary thing, not something thrust upon us by genetics or lack of aptitude or just sheer bad luck, things over which we have no control. This is something that we choose. In Christianity, the cross is central to what it means to be faithful. I'd like to be able to say otherwise, that crosses are kind of an optional part of the travel package. But in fact, they're both the mode of transportation on this journey, as well as the baggage we strap to our backs. That's a fairly bracing bit of information to hear from the cruise director, but Jesus as we've noted before, isn't a particularly good salesman. He's kind of the anti-Zig Ziglar. As Martin Hengels noted, for the people of the ancient world, Greeks, Romans, barbarians, and Jews, the cross was not just a matter of indifference, just any kind of death. It was an utterly offensive affair, obscene in the original sense of the word. Why? Well, the cross was something people got nailed to as a form of capital punishment. It's precisely this barbarity that Friedrich Nietzsche latches onto in his great book, Genealogy of Morals, in which he criticizes Christianity as a slave religion. Fascinating. See, what he says is that in contrast to the pacifism of Jesus, there's a manly sort of virility that the ancient Greeks and their heroic culture evinced that he considered to be the sort of pinnacle of human civilization, human moral achievement. So according to Nietzsche, Christianity successfully won the PR battle by convincing people that moral good consists of things like piety and kindness and humility, which he identifies as the last refuge of the powerless. The perfect symbol for this morality of the weak, Nietzsche believes, is the cross, which he says has this sort of debilitating narcotic power with its ghastly paradox of a crucified God. In the cross, Nietzsche laments, is the certainty that the pacifism of Jesus has by now triumphed over all other nobler virtues, courage, manliness, strength in battle. See, I think Nietzsche rightly saw that the power of Christianity doesn't come from making straight up claims to power by trying to be the boss, by supplanting the boss, but rather precisely from refusing to make those claims in favor of embracing weakness. The highest demonstration of which comes in the cross. More accurately than many Christians, Nietzsche recognized that at the very heart of Christianity sits the cross, a preference for what appears to the world as weakness, peace over violence, gentleness over cruelty, welcome over exclusion, love over hatred. Where he and I disagree isn't over whether this is true, but whether this weakness is a good thing. Followers of Jesus do think this powerlessness is a good thing. He's right, though, about one thing. The cross has been seen throughout history as not as an invitation to an adventure, but as a symbol of domesticated stability. But it's possible that in domesticating the cross, we no longer sense either its offensiveness or its glory and grandeur. See, in today's text, Jesus not only says that he's going toward the cross, but he invites us to go with him. He promises us that where the crucified are, that's where Jesus is going to be. If we're following Jesus, we're walking, you and I, toward the cross. But we're not walking that path alone. The call is to take up our crosses and follow Jesus with Jesus. He's walked down that road toward the cross, and he walks down that road again and again and again whenever the faithful bear their crosses. Having borne it before us, he's able to bear it with us. So let me ask you this. Is today's text good news or bad news? I mean, it sounds like bad news, doesn't it? The worst of all possible news. In a society in which pain and sacrifice are avoided and denied at all cost, in which any suffering is considered unfair and unnecessary, in which we're taught that every day in every way the world is growing into a kinder, more hospitable place where pain of all sorts will eventually be eradicated. But you see, the cross disabuses us of the facile notion that the meaning of life revolves around pleasure, around getting my needs met the way I think they need to be met. But what if the cross, at the same time as it delivers the bad news of suffering and sacrifice, offers us some good news? What if the cross, as fearsome and terrifying as it is the place where we meet Jesus? What if the cross allows us to consider that cross-carrying is not an individual, but a team sport? Even Jesus needed help lugging that lumber up the road. Not only do we find Jesus struggling under the load, but we find one another there also. Moreover, being near Jesus puts us near the poor, the disenfranchised, the powerless. And that's good news, because since we've embraced the cross, we've already embraced powerlessness, not as a strategy for effective living, but as a way of life that lacks that seeks above all else to be faithful to the calling to which we've been called. We don't have to wonder anymore whether we have any responsibility for our brothers and sisters, those who can't stand up any longer by themselves. We don't have to ask whether those who've been forgotten, abused, kicked to the curb are our people any longer. Through the grace of the cross, we're able to see not competitors in the food chain, not threats to our individual projects, not nuisances for which we have neither the time nor the energy, but brothers and sisters everywhere we look. People whom God created and loves still. Athol Gill points out that one of the profound paradoxes of Christianity is to be found in the fact that the one who was not able to carry his own cross is the one who enables us to carry ours. The cross isn't optional equipment for the journey of faith, but we don't have to bear it alone. One of my all-time favorite stories about one of my all-time favorite people, the Baptist prophet and writer, one-time civil rights movement pioneer, Will Campbell, is being escorted around church. And it's just been dedicated. Pastors are proudly showing him all the new things. And he points to this large cross which is suspended over the altar. And the pastor says, "Look at that. Can you believe that? That cross alone cost us $10,000. And Campbell muttered to himself, "Huh, amazing. There once was a time when they used to give you one of those for free, just for being faithful."
Thanks for tuning in to the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church podcast. Douglas Boulevard Christian Church is an open and affirming community of faith in the Highlands neighborhood of Louisville, Kentucky. Worship begins at 10:50 on Sundays, and we hope you'll join us sometime in person. Until then, you can find out more about us at our website, www.douglassblvdcc.com. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Our handle is @douglassblvdcc.